Today is Tuesday, May 14th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Just ahead, U.S. President Donald Trump reacted to new tariffs imposed on U.S. goods by China. The retaliatory measure sent markets down, but the president remained optimistic.
We're in a great position right now, no matter what we do.
Also, the Taliban's chief negotiator said that the United States is on the verge of defeat. Swedish prosecutors have announced they are reopening a rape case against WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange. And sadly, we say goodbye to an American idol. Those stories and more are ahead on today's International Edition. China is imposing tariffs on $60 billion worth of imports from the United States, retaliating after President Donald Trump boosted taxes on $200 billion worth of Chinese goods that sent to the United States and moved to impose duties on another $300 billion of Chinese exports. The Chinese Finance Ministry said on Monday its new 5 to 25% tax would be imposed on June 1st and effective 5,140 of U.S. products exported to China. Beijing said its response was targeting U.S. unilateralism and trade protectionism. But U.S. President Donald Trump remained unfazed by the latest development, even though American markets reacted negatively to the development, with the Dow Jones Industrial Average closing down over 600 points, representing a more than 2% loss.
China has been taking advantage of the United States for many, many years. I'm not just talking about during the Obama administration. You can go back long before that. And it's been taking out $400, $500, $600 billion a year out of the United States. And we can't let that happen. We're in a very strong position. Our economy has been very powerful. Theirs has not been. We've gone up a lot since our great election in 2016. And if you look at the numbers, they've gone down quite a bit. We're dealing with them. We have a very good relationship. Maybe something will happen. We're going to be meeting, as you know, at the G20 in Japan. And that'll be, I think, probably a very fruitful meeting. But we're taking in right now hundreds of billions of dollars. We're taking in billions of dollars of tariffs. And those tariffs are going to be tremendously, if you look at what we've done thus far with China, we've never taken in 10 cents until I got elected. Now we're taking in billions and billions.
Now, to put this latest development into context, I spoke with Monica DeBoyle, senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. China said on Friday it was going to retaliate. So really, what is your analysis? What is your take on what Beijing announced today?
Well, what they announced was essentially the inevitability of what happened with the breakdown in talks. I mean, they're not calling it a breakdown, but it is a breakdown in talks between the U.S. and China. So China basically decided that this was not the way to negotiate, and they decided not to back down, and they decided to retaliate and double down.
Is the Chinese retaliation, as you put it, their double down technique, is that reciprocal, or are they holding back to hopefully spur negotiations moving forward?
So they don't seem to be holding back. They seem to have understood two things about the most recent tactics by Trump. One is that the whole issue of China and the U.S. has become very political for Trump, and that the discussion over, you know, the potential agreement between China and the U.S. is now mired in the 2020 election. They can meet next month, they can meet in June, they can keep on talking throughout the rest of this year, but it's unlikely that there's going to be any sort of deal because now everything's hinging on Trump's bets for the 2020 presidential election. So having understood it that way, they've decided to go their own way in terms of retaliating.
You brought up, you know, reaching a deal, and Trump said he is going to meet with President Xi Jinping to discuss trade issues at the G20 in Japan at the end of June. You sound like you don't think that a deal can be reached by then.
No, I don't, because I think from the administration side, it's not only the tariffs. So what's at hand here, what's on the table, is not just, you know, the tariffs that have been applied to Chinese goods, the tariffs that China has applied to U.S. goods. It's more than that. The administration wants to see evidence from the Chinese and efforts by the Chinese to deal with intellectual property issues and to deal with certain things about China's development plan, the Made in China 2025, the industrial policy that China announced that envisages, you know, certain goals to be achieved by 2025. The U.S. sees its interest being hurt by that policy, and so they want to see some reversion of that policy or certain things. The U.S. wants certain things to be changed. The Chinese do not want to change any of these things. They do not want to touch their industrial policy, and the discussions over intellectual property rights, which impinge on Made in China 2025, also seem to be something that the Chinese do not want to deal with at this time. So that leaves very little room for any kind of negotiation.
We're talking about the number one and number two economies in the world. What about the rest of the world, the other economies that aren't necessarily entwined in this tit-for-tat tariff escalation? What about the number three, number four, number five economies? Will they see a pinch?
Well, this spills over on everybody, inevitably, because as you said, it's the two largest economies in the world that we're talking about here. So whatever trade goes on between the U.S. and China also affects, you know, the rest of these supply chains that run through the U.S. and China coming from other parts of the world. So inevitably, you know, everybody suffers in this. And if anything, they also suffer because of the uncertainty. I mean, the sheer uncertainty of having this trade war escalate is something that's going to affect investment globally, is something that's going to affect the global economy.
You brought up uncertainty, and we saw the Dow Jones Industrial Average drop more than 2% today. Markets hate uncertainty, but they knew that this retaliation was coming. They knew that the trade talks were not going well, that this could be a result. What do you see in the future for not only the U.S. markets, but, you know, global markets as they start to open on Tuesday?
Well, one thing is what I think we saw was, you know, the markets basically pricing in that this escalation of the trade war is likely going to last longer.
That was Monica DeBole, senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. Cameroon is facing worsening violence and conflict, and the number of people needing humanitarian assistance has increased 30% from last year to 4.3 million people. Mark Lowcock, the United Nations humanitarian chief, told an informal Security Council meeting on Monday the humanitarian situation in the Central African nation, this is dire, and it means that one in six Cameroonians need aid, and more than half of those needing aid are children. Lowcock identified three concurrent simultaneous humanitarian crises affecting eight of the 10 regions in the country.
Firstly, in its east and north regions, Cameroon is hosting more than 270,000 refugees from the Central African Republic, putting a significant burden on host communities who are already very poor and live in very fragile and vulnerable conditions. Second, Cameroon's far north remains affected by the Lake Chad Basin crisis. That, as you know, is one of the world's most severe humanitarian crises. 1.9 million people or so living in Cameroon's far north, that's half the population of that part of the country, need urgent assistance, and that includes 100,000 refugees or more from Nigeria. Thirdly, the humanitarian situation in the northwest and southwest regions has rapidly deteriorated.
The United States organized the informal meeting over objections from the Council's three African members and strong opposition from the Cameroonian government. Lowcock said the biggest challenge is lack of funding, noting that last year the United Nations appeal for Cameroon was among the least funded globally. This year, he said, the UN and non-governmental groups are seeking $299 million to reach 2.3 million people, one-third of them in the northwest and southwest regions. But so far, only $38 million has been received. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo made a hastily scheduled stop in Brussels, where he met with officials from European powers that are racing to salvage a nuclear deal with Iran. VOA's Pernell Murdoch reports.
While Pompeo met individually with the ministers, he did not do so in a joint setting or speak to reporters as he was entering or leaving EU headquarters. Instead, U.S. Special Representative Brian Hook briefed reporters.
The secretary shared information and intelligence with allies and discussed the multiple plot vectors emerging from Iran. We know that Europe shares our concerns about stability in the Gulf and in the Middle East.
Pompeo's stop in Brussels came shortly after two Saudi oil tankers and a Norwegian-flagged vessel were damaged in what Gulf officials described Monday as a sabotage attack off the coast of the United Arab Emirates. Hook said the UAE has asked the United States to assist in the investigation, and the U.S. will do so. He did not say if there's any evidence that Iran was behind the attack, but said that Tehran would be held responsible for any attacks by its proxies.
Our goal continues to be for Iran to behave like a normal nation and not like a revolutionary cause. They have been exporting violent revolution around the Middle East for 40 years.
Washington has warned shipping companies that Iran or its proxies could be targeting maritime traffic in the Persian Gulf region and said it was deploying an aircraft carrier and B-52 bombers to the Persian Gulf to counter alleged threats from Tehran.
We have put in place an entirely new foreign policy with respect to the Iranian regime. Iran's era of deniable attacks is over.
The United States pulled out of a 2015 nuclear accord between Tehran and six world powers a year ago, saying the agreement does nothing to stop Iran from developing missiles or destabilizing the Middle East. The European parties, Britain, France, Germany, and the European Union, insist the agreement was never meant to address those issues, but has been effective in curbing Iran's nuclear ambitions. Tensions mounted last week when Iranian President Hassan Rouhani gave the remaining signatories 60 days to come up with a plan to shield his country from sanctions imposed by U.S. President Donald Trump after the United States withdrew from the deal. Following his stop in Brussels, Pompeo heads to Sochi, Russia, to meet with Russian President Vladimir Putin and Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov. Pernell Murdoch, VOA News.
Here are other major stories from around the globe. The European Union called on Monday for a ceasefire in Libya, saying the conflict around the capital of Tripoli is a threat to international peace and security. The United Nations said it will report Tuesday whether rebel forces in Yemen carried out a key first step in the redeployment of forces from three key ports and is moving ahead to discuss with issues of their management. And Attorney General William Barr has appointed a U.S. attorney to examine the origins of the Russia investigation and determine if intelligence collection involving the Trump campaign was lawful and appropriate. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and more on the voanews.com website and on our mobile application. This is International Edition.
This is Science in a Minute.
A new study by researchers from Spain's University of Barcelona and the French Besançon Astronomical Observatory suggests that the Milky Way galaxy experienced a period of intense star-making about 2 to 3 billion years ago. Writing in the journal Astronomy and Astrophysics, the scientists reached their findings by analyzing data gathered by the European Space Agency's Gaia satellite. The researchers say they found that about half of the stars that make up the Milky Way's galactic disk were created during the stellar baby boom. Before the time of this boost in star formation, the scientists suggest that our galaxy was beginning to run low on the gas used to make stars when a satellite galaxy crashed into and merged with the Milky Way. It's thought that the satellite galaxy was rich with this gas, and when it merged with our home galaxy, boosted its star-making capabilities. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
V VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. The Taliban's chief negotiator has said the United States is on the verge of defeat and will quit Afghanistan soon, either out of their own accord or they will be forced out. Sher Mohammed Abbas Denekzai said the assertions in a speech to an internal gathering in Qatar just 2 days before he held a new round of talks with U.S. diplomats. Pro-Taliban social media outlets have released video of Denekzai's speech, and in that speech, he praised what he called the bravery of the Afghan nation for defeating past British and Soviet invasions of their country and resisting the foreign military presence, referring to the U.S.-led coalition training and advising pro-government forces in battles against the Taliban. Denekzai also criticized Afghan President Ashraf Ghani. VOA's Ayaz Gul is in Islamabad and has been covering the peace talks between the Taliban and the United States. He spoke with my colleague Kate Pound Dawson about Denekzai's comments and what they might mean for the talks with U.S. Special Representative for Afghan Reconciliation, Zalmay Khalilzad.
Yeah, it is an interesting statement in a sense that this has come out from Sher Mohammed Abbas Denekzai, who is the chief negotiator for the Taliban team, which has been holding peace talks with American interlocutors for the last many months. It shows that the Taliban, they're not showing any flexibility about if the U.S. wants them to agree to the existing constitution in Afghanistan or the political system and be part of that. The statement clearly suggests that they are sensing victory, and that's what Denekzai has predicted in his statement, that the U.S. is about to leave Afghanistan, whether through a settlement or that it will be forced, suggesting that the Taliban are having an upper hand in the battlefield. So this clearly indicates that the Taliban are engaging the U.S. maybe trying to buy time, because they understand that the Trump administration apparently seems to be taking steps that suggest that they're in a hurry to withdraw troops from Afghanistan. Like there have been three developments over the last few months. So one, President Trump said that if there is progress in talks with the Taliban, that he may cut to half the number of American forces in Afghanistan. Secondly, there were reports that the embassy staff in Kabul is also being downsized seriously. And now we have, over the last 2-3 days, Pentagon has announced that they are diverting like more than $600 million that were allocated for Afghan security forces training program to help build the wall on the Mexico border. So these developments could be giving Taliban an impression that Washington is in a hurry to leave Afghanistan.
Does a statement like this, in which the Taliban leadership is clearly indicating a position, does this sort of statement, is it likely to affect the negotiations with the United States?
Well, that obviously is a challenging situation. It poses a challenge for the United States because it has been trying to convince the current government in Kabul, led by President Ashraf Ghani, that whatever understanding they will reach will be within the limits of the constitution of Afghanistan. But so it will now give more fuel to President Ashraf Ghani, who is already upset at the United States because his government has been kept out of this dialogue process, and that he's going to, obviously take this issue with the U.S. that the Taliban really don't want any democratic system in the country, and they are simply seeking restoration of their Islamic Emirate that the Taliban used to call their government in 2001, that was ousted by the U.S.-led military coalition.
Now, I understand from your report that Denekzai directly criticized President Ghani. What do you think the response to that is going to be in Kabul?
Yeah, it was quite a criticism, in a sense that he was mocking President Ghani, and he was comparing him with the Afghan leaders who were in control when the Soviet forces were occupying Afghanistan. So basically, Sanizai was saying that Ghani and his advisors and his members of his government are basically stooges of the United States and holding them responsible for the ongoing bloodshed in the country. Obviously, this clearly indicates that the Taliban may want a reconciliation, but that they haven't forgotten, or they are sending a message that leaders who are currently on the side of the United States in Afghanistan, they, you know, there could be serious repercussions for them if the Taliban come to power. So, I mean, these are the inferences now one can draw from Sanazai's statement that they really want to get back to power and they want to punish those who Sanazai suggested facilitated the U.S.-led invasion of Afghanistan 17 years ago.
That was Ayaz Gul in Islamabad speaking to my colleague Kate Pound-Dawson. Swedish prosecutors announced on Monday they were reopening the rape case against WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange following a request from the lawyer of one of the alleged victims. Assange was arrested last month in the Ecuadorian embassy in London after the South American nation reversed its decision to give him asylum. As Henry Ridgewell reports, Assange is also wanted in the United States on hacking charges, and the British government will now have to decide which extradition request it should take as a priority.
Julian Assange was accused of rape by two women following a WikiLeaks conference in Stockholm in 2011. He sought asylum in London's Ecuadorian embassy, claiming the accusations were part of a plot to have him extradited to the United States over his whistleblowing activities. Swedish prosecutors dropped the investigation in 2017. But last month, Ecuador reversed its decision to offer Assange asylum and allowed British authorities into its London embassy to arrest him. One of the women who made the rape accusations requested the case be reopened, and Swedish prosecutors made this announcement Monday.
After reviewing the preliminary investigation in its current state, my assessment is that there is still probable cause to suspect that Julian Assange committed rape.
Assange denies the rape accusations. In a statement, WikiLeaks said the reopening of the case would allow him to clear his name. Sweden will seek extradition after Assange has served his 50-week jail sentence in Britain for skipping bail. The United States has also issued an extradition request for Assange over computer hacking accusations related to the release of thousands of classified military and diplomatic communications. Britain's Home Secretary will have to decide which extradition request should take precedence.
Whether it was hacking into computers or simply releasing information against the allegations made in Sweden, which is of the utmost severity. So it will come down politically to which one he thinks is more palatable for him to make.
Assange has already indicated he would contest any extradition to the United States.
He no doubt will have fears he will be held in solitary confinement in conditions which he will say will breach his human rights. There's also concerns that if he is sent to the US, they will simply add further charges onto him once he is there. And it also depends on how the US frame the charges against him. They will have to show that what he's accused of in the US would amount to an offence in the UK.
Under Swedish law, the statute of limitations on the rape case expires in August next year, so legal experts say there is pressure on Britain and Sweden to speed up the extradition process. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
And you're listening to VOA's International Edition.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, as Malawi gears up for elections on May 21st, candidates and voters say flooding from Cyclone Idai is negatively impacting the vote. Uncertainty at the polls on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
our voices. We're talking about the news and issues you're talking about.
Sharing stories of development and growth across Africa, around the world, and in our lives. Topics that inform, empower,
and change the rules.
It's time for Our Voices with me, Haiti Adams Fitzpatrick.
And Hadiza Kiari.
And Ayan Bior.
And Orion Itangi Shaka.
Join us on Facebook at VOA Our Voices.
It's time for Our Voices.
This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller. South Africa has the largest population of rhinos in the world and also has been the country hardest hit by poaching. Between 2007 and 2015, there was a 9,000% increase in poaching, reaching a height of 1,215 animals in 2014. While numbers have been declining since then, poaching remains a problem. However, technology is helping turn one game reserve into a high-tech fortress, and VOA's Faith Lapidus has that story.
African wildlife, a major source of tourist dollars, is threatened by poachers. Despite aerial surveillance, foot patrols, and electrified fences, illegal incursions are still being made into South Africa's parks. But not in Mpumalanga Game Reserve, a private game reserve adjacent to Kruger National Park, where technology is being used to track the movements of people and potential poachers. Using closed-circuit TV, long-range thermal cameras, sensors, and a Wi-Fi network, technology firms Cisco and Dimension Data implemented a pilot project called Connected Conservation, focused on protecting rhinos.
There was a desperate need to stop poaching, and we came along, Dimension Data, together with Cisco, had a look at the environment with our solution architects, our design architects from both companies, put a solution together effectively, designed it, implemented it, and had some great successes, particularly in our first year of operation, which was 2016. We reduced poaching by 96%, and from January 2017 to date, we have not had a rhino poached.
With information from the various cameras and sensors monitored and collected in a central 24-hour control room, ranger response times have dropped from 30 to 7 minutes.
It gives us now the visibility on areas where we previously did not have visibility. And, you know, you can hide your tracks when crossing a road, but you cannot hide in front of a camera. So that gives us that opportunity to make sure that we see the people, and then we can react by means of human intervention.
Connected Conservation aims to provide their system across the globe, minimizing poaching of other at-risk animals.
Obviously, looking throughout Africa, looking to save species like the rhino, the elephant, lion, and pangolin. We've got two requests out of India to do two tiger sanctuaries. Looking at Asia to protect the tigers as well. Having a look at the ocean, we've had a call out of Bay in New Zealand to protect sea rays, whales, and sharks. And then obviously in South America, we want to go in there and protect the jaguar and the mountain lion as well.
By creating a virtual wall around the preserves, the project hopes to protect the animals while allowing them to roam freely. Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
Actress and singer Doris Day, whose wholesome screen presence made her a widely popular movie star in the 1950s and 60s, has died at the age of 97. Her Doris Day Animal Foundation says Day died early Monday at her Carmel Valley home in California from complications from serious case of pneumonia. Day's films included dramas, musicals, and romantic comedies with some of the biggest male leads of the day, making her a top star in the 1950s and 60s and among the most popular screen actresses in history. Day's had hit records, and most notably, Que Sera Sera from the movie The Man Who Knew Too Much. Day was given the Cecil B. DeMille Life Achievement Award from the Golden Globes, a Presidential Medal of Freedom in 2004, and a Lifetime Achievement Honor from the Los Angeles Film Critics Association. And that is going to do it for us today. On behalf of our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Jimmy Cook, Thank you so much for joining us. For pictures, videos, stories, and more, be sure to follow Voice of America on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And don't forget, with our VOA mobile app, you can download our stories and take them with you. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Have a terrific Tuesday.
Now I have children of my own. They ask their mother, what will I be?
This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil.